You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And greetings, and welcome back to me from vacation. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you. Louise and I, let me back up. About a year ago, almost a year ago, my sister-in-law, one of my brother's sisters, remembering back to a vacation that we had taken, my brother and his wife and their kids, and Louise and I and our kids, many years ago, actually back in the 80s, in the mid-80s, we went down to Cancun for a week. And, in fact, the place where we stayed, La Ciba Morales, got wiped out in the hurricane that came in the late 80s. And back then, that whole beach was all just jungle. And so, anyhow, my sister-in-law said, let's organize a vacation. And so, way back in, like, I don't know, the fall of last year, anyhow, maybe even the summer of last year, she nailed down a condo on the beach in Cancun for a week. And so last week we were on vacation for a week. I don't announce my vacations. In fact, I don't announce my time off before I take it for a couple of reasons. The main one being that it's like saying I'm not going to be around my house. And, you know, generally I'm guessing most of you don't like run around the neighborhood announcing if your house is going to be empty for the next 24 hours or 48 hours or a week. In fact, it's a really good rule. Don't tell people, you know, that your house or, in our case, your boat is going to be empty. And there are other variations of that, you know, that just have to do with personal privacy and safety and just being rational. And so that's why, you know, when I take a vacation, I don't, you know, for a week in advance say, get ready, I'm going to be gone. It's so funny because that week that we were gone, this last week that we were down in Mexico, you know, the Ukraine melted down, RT melted down, we're on RT, and all these conspiracy theories, you know, people like, oh my God, you know, they won't let Hartmann on the air and he's gone from the radio and what's the future? I was on vacation. It had been planned a year in advance. I'm sorry I didn't, you know, tell you, and I didn't want my fill-in hosts to mention it either, because that means he's going to be on vacation tomorrow, which means his house is still empty. You know, it's just like something you don't do. But I'm back, and you know, unlike Rush Limbaugh, I can't afford, like, security to, you know, live in the west wing of my house for the week that I'm gone. So anyhow. But we're back, and very pleased to be back, And I'm going to point out tonight on RT that, just for the record, we've been almost 3 years on that network. And I know Liz created quite a kerfuffle when she quit on the air. But I have – now, first of all, we're not employees of RT. We produce a show that Louise and I own. It's owned by the same production company that owns this radio show, which is us. It's just my wife and I. And it has been on the air on RT for 2.5 years. It'll be 3 years, I think, October or November. And much like when we were on the air on Air America, there were only two shows on Air America that were owned by their talent, to the best of my knowledge. Everybody else was an employee of Air America, and I don't like being employees of anybody. And it's not that I don't like it. It's that I've always been good at starting my own businesses. I'd rather run my own show. And I haven't been an employee since I was 18 or 19. I'm just probably really bad at it. And so when, you know, Air America was interested in our show, we said to them, yeah, we'll license it to you, but we produce it, we own it, and the licensing agreement is going to say that you have no editorial control over our show. So as much as it gave Mark Green indigestion when we were on Air America, they did not have the ability at all. I mean, you know, to say, hey, would you put this guest on? Don't put that guest on. How about talking about this? Any of that kind of stuff didn't happen. And, you know, we wrote a similar contract with RT that said, we own our show. We have complete editorial independence. Take it or leave it. And if they don't like the show, they can take it off the air, but that's about it. And in the 2.5 years that I've been on the air on RT, not once has anybody from RT ever said, you shouldn't have said that, or I wish you'd say this, or have you thought about this guest, or you shouldn't have had that. Nothing. Not a word. They have completely respected our editorial integrity. And I have to say also, you know, our radio show on the not-for-profit side, this show that you're listening to right now is syndicated by Pacifica. Thank you. Brain fart. This is what happens when you go on vacation. It's going to take me a day or two to get my brain working again. Pacifica syndicates us on the nonprofit side, and we've never had any editorial feedback from them. And on the for-profit side, we're on for-profit radio stations all over the country. We're syndicated by Westwood One, and Westwood One and the company that they bought that previously syndicated us, which was Dial Global, and then the company before that, which was Jones Radio, none of them have ever, and the company before that, actually, i.e. America Radio, none of them have ever tried to influence the content of our show. Now, you know, maybe it's because we said in a contract at the very get-go, you can't, but I think it's just, you know, that's pretty much how business is done in the media. So, and I can tell you, I have some knowledge. I don't want to say I know, like, you know, good buddies with or whatever, but, you know, I know some of the people who are involved in syndicating, like, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity's show. And they don't tell that talent what to say either. It just generally isn't done. So anyhow, for those of you who are worried about, you know, where's Tom? I was in Cancun laying on the beach. Seriously. Something I haven't done in many, many years. Okay. Now, to the news. There's a bunch of stuff. First of all, I'm just back. And so I asked Sean, I do want to talk about the situation in Ukraine. But we're going to do that in our third hour. We're going to get Steve Cohen back on. He was with us some weeks ago, professor emeritus at New York University and at Princeton, contributing editor to The Nation, to talk about what's going on in Ukraine. And I'm looking forward to that conversation, but we'll hold that off for a couple of hours. I do want to talk to you about asset bubbles and the possible destruction of the American economy, which has nothing to do with the Ukraine, unless we get into a war, God forbid. I want to get into that. I want to get into, in the next hour, Michelle Bachelet. She's going to be the president of Chile again. And this is something you're not going to hear on the corporate news. This is a complete repudiation of Reaganomics and, more aggressively, a complete repudiation of libertarian Milton Friedman Chicago School economics. And that's a big deal. And a very interesting science article that I want to share with you also about what might be the mechanism involved in gluten intolerance. And we just spent all day yesterday with one of my best friends who lives in Australia, and he's a neuroscientist. He's a professor of neuroscience at Swinburne University, I believe. And yeah, it's one of the universities in Australia, in Melbourne. And he's doing just some brilliant brain research work, and maybe we'll have an opportunity to blither a little bit about, you know, how the brain works and some of the things that I learned from hanging around with my friend Richard yesterday and this morning over breakfast. So, and one last thing. This is fascinating. Did you know that the Stand Your Ground law in Florida could be read to say that if somebody goes into court and shoots the judge and the prosecutor who are trying to put them in jail for defending themselves, that they would have a stand-your-ground defense? I'll explain that after the break, but the way the stand-your-ground law is written, it could open up a citizen's legal right to assassinate judges and lawyers. Fascinating. Now, this after a guy tried to kill a police officer, or did kill a police officer, and tried to use stand-your-ground to defend himself. I'll tell you all about that in a few minutes, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So Sue Nethercutt says, did you manage not to do any work? Well, I did finish up a novel that's coming out this fall while I was on vacation. So, no, I didn't manage not to do any work. And welcome back. Let me get the mouse over here. Andrew Campbell, senior producer of The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So where are we starting today? Are we still going to start with Venezuela?
Yeah, we're going to start off talking about what's going on in Venezuela. It's been overshadowed a lot by what's been taking place in Ukraine and Crimea. And when the mainstream media has approached the issue, they've really put on the whole spin that Venezuela is a ultra-authoritarian country with a dictator for a leader. And that's not necessarily the case. So we're going to get into why Americans are getting that spin from the media and what influences are making us hear that. And we're going to be speaking with Gregory Wilpert. He's the founder of VenezuelaAnalysis.com and author of Changing Venezuela by Taking Power.
Fascinating. Okay. Yep. And then who's reading your emails now?
Yeah, it looks like Google is in cahoots with Oakland, California. There's a story that came out. Basically, what's going on is Oakland got a federal grant to build this massive surveillance hub in the center of the city, something straight out of Mission Impossible in the movies. And they say it's just for public safety reasons and just to monitor traffic cameras and red light speeders and stop sign dodgers. But there's more to it than that. And it turns out that Oakland officials have been speaking with Google about getting in on all the action that's taking place at this intelligence hub. And there might even be some military contractor involvement here. So we'll get into what's going on. And
That's all right, creepy.
Yeah.
And if it's happening in Oakland, it could be happening where you live.
If it's happening in Oakland, chances are major cities across America are getting in on the game, too.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then in our also in that block, we're going to get into private detention facilities.
Yeah, there's a story out now that a privately owned immigration detention facility in California is facing has a lot of inmates right now that are on hunger strikes that are protesting conditions there. And we'll use that as a segue to really debate the whole issue of privatized prisons in America and how bad they really are. I mean, the prisons are the commons, and they should be, but there's been this unprecedented wave of corporate takeover of these prisons, and they're turning people into profit margins and not actual people.
One story you might want to check out, Andrew, over at Raw Story. The headline says, FBI takes over investigation into Idaho's privately operated Gladiator School prison.
Yeah, we can definitely throw that in there.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And, in fact, this is going to be a debate, so it should be really interesting. And then the BP oil stills.
Yeah, we'll be talking to Mike Papantonio, who hosted and did a great job for you last week. Mm-hmm. But we'll be bringing him in, and he's done a lot of work with BP, and then obviously it's sort of fallen off the mainstream media's radar in the last year or two, but there's a lot going on, a lot of new stuff going on, and we'll get into that with him.
Great. Okay, and then, and our Best of the Rest news? Well, that is our Best of the Rest, right?
Yeah, we'll also have an Everything You Know Is Wrong today, talking about the therapeutic potential of LSD for those that are suffering with anxiety leading up to death.
Yeah, this is something that back in the 60s, Richard Alpert, who we know as Ram Dass, they were doing that kind of work back then, working with dying people with LSD. It was very successful, so I'm glad to see it back. And then our daily take about the failed libertarian experiment in Chile.
Exactly.
Okay, Andrew Campbell, great to see you, Andrew. Thank you. I'll see you in a few hours. We'll be right back. Past the hour, and by the way, that week that I was off, I had a bunch of fill-in hosts here on radio and also over on TV who just did spectacular jobs, and I want to thank Danielle and Shano for filling in for me for a day. Mike Papantonio, I think, filled in for 2 days, was it? I was on TV, that's right. Dr. Mike filled in for us from Phoenix, and Leslie Marshall, and Sam Cedar, and so it was just, you know, an all-star week. And, you know, voting for best host? No, we're not. So anyhow, we had a great time. And I appreciate I got a lot of good emails from people saying, whoa, you know, this is a great show you've got filling in for you today. So, all right, I wanted to talk about this crash stuff and the science. Oh, Gavin Newsom. This is the Lieutenant Governor of California. He says, it's time to legalize, time to regulate. Let's make pot just like alcohol and tobacco. You think? George Zimmerman was at a gun show over the weekend in Orlando signing autographs. Now, just think about that for a minute. The one thing that this guy is famous for is shooting and killing an unarmed black teenager. That's the only thing he's famous for. and getting away with it. And people are showing up to get his autograph and to shake his hand. Now, it turns out that not a lot of people showed up at this gun show to see George Zimmerman. A lot of people went to the gun show and didn't bother with George Zimmerman. But apparently some did, and he, it's just bizarre. He was autographing old pictures of himself. Anyhow, there's a loophole in the Stand Your Ground law. This is a fascinating little legal theory, and I know, Shano, you're gonna love wrapping your head around this one. Kenan Finkelstein shot a sheriff's deputy who was pursuing a robbery suspect. He was not pursuing Kenan Finkelstein, but he ran across Kenan's property, and Kenan got nervous and shot the guy. And so in his defense, he said, stand your ground. Well, it turns out the Stand Your Ground law has a paragraph in it that says the person against whom the defensive force is used is a law enforcement officer, as defined in 943, who enters or attempts to enter a dwelling, residence, or vehicle in the performance of his or her official duties, and the officer identifies himself or herself in accordance with any applicable law, or the person using force knew or reasonably should have known that the person entering or attempting to enter was a law enforcement officer. That person, that you can't use Stand Your Ground against a law enforcement officer. But this from Addicting Info, this is an article by Nathaniel Downs. He says, but the law is so broadly written that aside from actual police officers, all others are fair game, including judges and lawyers. So let's say a guy's up for capital offense, kills somebody, kills his wife, kills his brother, kills somebody, some guy down the street, whatever. And he goes into court, and Florida's a death penalty state. So he goes into court, and the judge and the prosecutor are trying to kill this guy. Now, understand your ground. He is now at reasonable fear for his life. Right? Because if the prosecutor and the judge are successful, he will get a lethal injection or some, you know, he'll be killed. So it would be a legal defense. So he, reading this piece, he says he's facing the death penalty. He could use using the Stand Your Ground law, kill both the prosecutor pursuing the death penalty and the judge overseeing the case, and it would be a legal defense for the killing. There's nothing within Florida law preventing such a scenario. Or even more so, imagine someone who's having their medical care denied by a politician who has voted to expand, who has refused to vote to expand Medicaid in the state. This is truly a threat to life under the law. If Stand Your Ground is correct, would it not be permitted to murder a politician, all without recrimination? Now, you know, obviously, I think that this is an absurd argument, and I don't think that it would stand up in court. But that said, it demonstrates how crazy this law was constructed. How just absolutely flat out crazy. Okay. And Craigslist personals. I missed CPAC this week. And so not only did I miss and you missed, you know, my debating the craziest of the crazies, unfortunately, this last week. Typically, CPAC is the last week of February. And so way back last year, middle of last year, when Louise and Connie planned our vacation, we booked it for the first week of March, thinking that CPAC would be the week before, but it wasn't. They moved it to the first week of March. So anyhow, I didn't do CPAC. But the other thing you missed was all the Craigslist personals. CPAC looking for discreet fun. Man, this is man for man. Staying in town for the conference, looking to get my rocks off, discretion assured. Versatile-looking man in his 20s or 30s. Another one, CPAC, I need a man now. Okay, so I spend so much time in rural Indiana, CPAC is my only outlet for this sort of thing. What I'm looking for, you, a masculine Ayn Rand type, the 47%, and I want you to slap me around hard and give it to me good. Okay, you could bust in my room, catch me trying to enroll in a healthcare marketplace, state exchange, and punish me for it. Punish me good. We can meet in the bar first if you want. I'll be wearing khakis and a navy blue blazer. It's a Craigslist. Actual ad. Now, it might be a joke, but who knows? I mean, Big Dad seeks trim college bottom CPAC. Okay, I promised you the information on the crash. This over the last 5 days, I have been reading the Financial Times every day, as is my wont. And today, Seth Klarman is the fourth most successful investor in the world, hedge fund investor, behind George Soros and John Paulson and Ray Dalio. He made $4 billion for his clients last year. You can't buy into his hedge fund anymore. And he's saying, look out. And I quote from today's Financial Times, when the markets reverse, everything investors thought they knew will be turned upside down and inside out. Buy the dips will be replaced with what was I thinking? Anyone who is poorly positioned and ill-prepared will find there's a long way to fall. Few, if any, will escape unscathed. End of quote.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I will, after the break, go into a little more detail on that and a few of the other pieces. And also, we're going to pick up your calls. We'll just make it kind of an anything goes day. I'm back. You're there. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing. This breaking news just came out. March 10th, yeah, this is today. I mean, how this is happening, and none of us had any idea. There are 28 Democrats, led by California's Senator Barbara Boxer and Hawaii's Brian Schatz and Rhode Island's Sheldon Whitehouse, who are going to try to push Congress toward action on climate change. It's not actually a filibuster because there's no actual legislation up for debate, according to Gabriel Levy over at the EPI. But a number of vulnerable Democrats are not going to show up. That's interesting. Thomas Steyer, the Next Gen Political Action Group, has refused to spend. He's got $100 million. Wow. To support, see, this is Citizens United. Now we got a billionaire on the left. And he says, I got $100 billion to help you get reelected, but it's not going to go to anybody who has refused to spend any of its pledged $100 million on Democrats who oppose climate regulation. Okay, there's a double negative there. Let's unpack that. I hate people who write with... Oh, I don't hate people, but I hate writing this double negatives. Okay, so if he's refused to spend money on Democrats who oppose climate regulation, then he is willing to spend money on Democrats who support climate regulation, right? You take out both negatives? So if I'm reading this right, billionaire Thomas Steyer is going to support Democrats with his $100 million that he's going to throw into this next election cycle, apparently. According to this UPI report, is only going to give that money to Democrats who support climate regulation. And now you've got 28 Democrats who are going to be, they're going to pull an all-nighter tonight on the floor of the Senate. You know, good on them, on the one hand. On the other hand, if this is a way of making sure that the faucet is open for campaign funds, well, you know, It is the post-Citizens United world. What can you say? But anyhow, I was trying to call Louise just before the break to say, can we get one of these senators on the show to tell us about this? But she wasn't answering her phone. So, Sean, if you're listening, see what you can do. Shano just sent you and Louise the link to the story. Back to the crash. In my book, The Crash of 2016, I suggest that the crash that happened in 2008 wasn't as bad or as severe as it could have been because Obama intervened in the marketplace. I mean, Bush intervened in the marketplace first, you know, with the bank bailout. But that, I mean, that saved the banks, but that's not what saved the economy. What saved the economy was stimulus spending, the stimulus bill that Obama got passed as soon as he became president. And that's, in fact, when the job hemorrhaging turned around. You've probably all seen the famous kind of bikini graph where, you know, you've got the jobs just crashing under the last 6 months of Bush and the first month of Obama, and then the jobs legislation, the stimulus gets passed, and boom, the jobs go back up again. What went up along with jobs was the stock market. The Standard & Poor's, you know, there's two major ratings for the stock market, S&P and the Dow. And the Dow had fallen from like 13,000 to like 6,000 or 7,000. I'm doing this from memory, and it's a few years old, but it was a pretty substantial drop. The S&P had a very, very, you know, a drop that produces a little more thoughtful response, or sometimes not. And that is the S&P went down to 666. I'm not making this up. And so on Saturday, as Louise and I are flying home from Mexico, we're changing planes in Houston, and I grabbed a copy of the Financial Times, and here on the back page, on the same page of the Lex column, it's my favorite page to read, there was an article by John Authors, which I just reprinted, titled Number Games, Was 666 Low Enough in 2009? Now, the argument that I make in Crash of 2016 is that we didn't go as low as we could have. He's arguing that we should have gone lower than 666. Not just could have, but should have. He quotes stock market historian Russell Napier, and he says, you look at the four great U.S. market bottoms, 1921, there was a big crash right after Harding was elected and dropped the top tax rate. There was a big crash in 30, the bottom of the market. Okay, these are market bottoms. The bottom of the market was, actually the market crashed before 21. So anyhow, in 33, you had the crash that started in 1929. It hit bottom in 33. You had a crash in right after World War II in 47 or 48 that hit bottom, maybe 46, that hit bottom in 49. And you had a crash in 1982 that only lasted, a year or so. The early Reagan crash. And he makes the point that 666 was only 14% below the long-term average of these stocks, what's called Tobin's Q, the stock market ratio, the value of the stock to the stock market's ratio of the total replacement value of all of its assets. You know, and it's a fancy way of saying they came up with this formula. And 666 was 14% below that, but in all the other stock market crashes, the low was 50% below that. That's the point at which the market begins to recover. And that didn't happen. And so they're thinking, you know, it could be. Now, this was on Saturday. Today, Monday, we've got Seth Klarman, you know, one of the most famous investors in the world. He's so famous that the book he wrote on investment that is no longer in print sells secondhand on Amazon for $2,900 a copy. He made $4 billion for his clients last year. He's referred to by the Financial Times as one of the world's most respected investors. Baupost Group is his hedge fund. It manages $27 billion. It has, as Miles Johnson, the hedge fund correspondent for the Financial Times, notes, a cult-like following. And he said, Mr. Klarman pointed out, that last year the S&P went up 32% and the NASDAQ went up 40%. But corporate earnings did not go up. So why is the stock market going up? Now, I would answer that question very simply by saying hot money. You've got the top 0.1%, the top 0.01%, who make most of their money through capital gains. They're paying a maximum income tax rate of 20%. And many of them are paying far less than 20%. Look at Mitt Romney. They pay virtually nothing at all. And in many years, they pay nothing. And so the money is like, you know, it comes really easy. Easy come, easy go. And so they are gambling with this money. And in gambling with this money, we have a new housing bubble that has developed in Florida as a result of hedge fund speculation. And not just Florida. It's happening all over the country. You've got hedge funds coming in. You've got foreign pools of cash, Chinese, Saudi, coming in, buying up homes, buying up property. But more importantly, you've got, you know, it's like, where can we put our money? Oh, you put it in the market. So there's one investment newsletter that I follow. It's the Aden Forecast, A-D-E-N Forecast. And last week they were suggesting maybe it's time to buy bonds, to go to like TLT, which is a bond mutual fund. Which, you know, I can't say that they're saying the crash is coming, but I mean, typically that's what you do if you think a crash is coming, is you move your money into bonds, or at least some of it. So, anyhow, I just, you know, the net of this is not so much, oh my God, a crash is coming, but rather we need to fix the structural stuff that prevents a crash from happening. We need to repeal Gramm-Leach-Bliley and put Glass-Steagall back into place. We need to re-regulate the banks. We need to, I mean, basically we need to repudiate the 32 years of Reaganomics that we've been living under since Reagan took office. He stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We need to start enforcing it. We need to break up the big banks, break up the big media companies, break up the big, industrial combines, break up the big pharmaceutical, break up the big food companies, break up big ag. I mean, you name the industry or sector, and it has come to be dominated by fewer than six companies. That's not a healthy economy. That's an oligarchy or an oligonomy. And it needs to be broken up. And we need to re-regulate our banks. And we need to raise the top tax, the top income tax, on money easily gained, on money over $1 million a year. Nobody earns more than $1 million a year by being, you know, super smart or working super hard. It's after that point, it's gambling money. We need to raise that top income tax rate above 50%, which history tells us stabilizes markets. And we need to put a very small transaction tax on every stock sold or bought to stop the 70% of the activity in the stock market, which is being run by computers in New York City, this program trading. Just a simple set of things that will prevent a crash from happening or will put us back together after the next one happens. But I'm telling you, get ready.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And all that said, I'm going to move the rest of the stuff that I was going to talk about into the next hour and pick up your calls after the break. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes before the hour. And how did we not find out about it if they've been planning it for months? Do you know? No? Or I guess I just wasn't paying attention. Anyhow, Tracy watching Free Speech TV in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Tracy, I wasn't watching CPAC, but apparently you were.
Yeah, it was making me sick. Everyone was coming out on the stage saying, the liberals do this, the liberals do that. Well, then I found this in Isaiah 33. The fool will no longer be called noble nor the crafty greedy, said to be bountiful and princely. For the fool speaks folly, and his mind plans iniquity. Like Paul Ryan lied up there. That was on the news on Link TV. Practicing profane ungodliness, speaking error concerning to the Lord, leaving the craving of the hungry unsatisfied, and causing the drink of the thirsty to fail.
Yeah.
The instruments and the methods of the fraudulent greedy are evil. He devises wicked devices and to ruin the poor.
Okay,
and
Tracy, we have kind of a rule here on the show about not reading on the air, but I get your Bible quote. Where is that from again?
It's liberal. It's the word liberal is in chapter 32 with Isaiah. And God is saying that the open-hearted person and the noble person and the liberal person will, that's what God wants them to
do. Isaiah 33?
Open-hearted and generous. It's 32.
Isaiah 32. That's amazing. Well, I mean, you know, that was the group, basically, that came up with the idea of the Jubilee, the, you know, free all the slaves, equalize all the wealth. Yeah, so I'm not surprised. I'm impressed. I didn't remember having read that in the Bible.
I, I have one of those dictionaries like a preacher has in his office to look up words.
Yeah.
And there, and this is mostly just three of those in using liberal four times in the Bible. But I'm telling you, liberal is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, in society.
No, it's not. It is liberals are the people who are following. The Christian liberals are the ones who are following Jesus' injunction in Matthew 25. I'm with you. Tracy, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Richard in Upper Tract, West Virginia. Actually, Richard, hang on just a minute. I want to pick up your call after the break, because you're on a topic that I think is going to be a really good topic, and I want to get into it a little more. This fame sucker put this up over at Democratic Underground this morning. The single most powerful moral statement the USA could make against Putin moving into the Crimea would be to put Dick and W on trial for Iraq. Extra points for conviction for war crimes. Yeah. I mean, then I think we would have some moral authority, I suppose, but I don't get where our interests, why there's so much chest thumping going on around Ukraine. It's like, what does this have to do with the United States? 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be back. So Democrats have been plotting this all-nighter for several months, according to Ed O'Keefe over at the Washington Post, and according to Shano, who apparently reads the news better than I do. And it's just a variation on what Rand Paul and Ted Cruz did, only without green eggs and ham. Well, we'll have to wait and see, actually. Who knows? Richard in Upper Tract, West Virginia. Hey, Richard, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, thank you, Tom. I love your show. I come right to the point. For the longest period of time in my life, I was a libertarian, serious type, you know, give money, run for office, collect petitions. And now I no longer can accept it. I see things more, much more your way. The problem I have is, should I call myself now a liberal or a progressive? I don't care much for the term liberal because of the connotations to the Clintons and to Nancy Pelosi and to the neoliberals.
Yeah.
I prefer progressive, but I want to ask you how you feel about it.
I call myself a progressive or a democratic socialist. I'm curious, what was the, Richard, what was the thing that caused you to abandon libertarianism?
Well, I began to see this childishness and the greed and, you know, and the fact that, oh, I'm okay, but, you may have a handicap. You maybe have a IQ of 70. Well, the heck with you. I'm okay. Right. I don't worry about you.
Right.
And, I just, as a Christian, I just found that to be just so unsatisfying.
Yeah. Well, and it's antithetical to Christianity. I mean, Ayn Rand came out and said anybody who's religious is a fool. I mean, which is how, you know, not all libertarians, but certainly all objectivists view anybody who would call themselves a Christian. And I call myself a Christian, and I think that, you know, there are some important things that are said there. And so I'm not sure what you should call yourself, Richard, but whatever it is, it should be the thing that makes you feel good. And Bernie Sanders once on this show went into a riff about the difference between a liberal and a progressive. And my recollection is that he was saying that progressives are more concerned. Actually, I shouldn't say my recollection of what he said, because I might be wrong. I'll have to ask him on Friday, and I'll try to remember to do that. In my mind, there's not much of a difference, but both words have been used over time. I think progressives are more involved in actually trying to produce social change, and liberals are more involved in trying to Well, that makes them sound like conservatives. I don't know the difference, Richard. I'm sorry. So you can call yourself anything you want. Thanks for the call, though, and good on you for waking up. Patrick in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
How's it going, Tom?
Good.
I just got a joke from you. I was watching RT this morning,
uh-huh.
And it was a guy with it sounded like he had some one of the Slavic languages in his voice, but what he said was, war is God's way of teaching Americans geography.
It seems to be. You know, we didn't know where Iraq was until we invaded it. We didn't know where Afghanistan was until we invaded it. Nobody knew anything about the Ukraine or where it was until we started talking about, you know, conflict.
Yeah, Ukraine, I want to go there now. I want to ride my bicycle through it.
Yeah. It's actually, you know, when we lived in Europe for that year in Germany, Herr Müller wanted to go to a nudist colony in the Crimean Peninsula. We never made it, but Louise was not all that fond of the idea of let's go to a nudist colony. But that was his big idea. Apparently, there's some great resorts, in that southern region around the Black Sea. So, Patrick, thanks for the call. It is God's way of teaching us geography. Catherine in Seattle. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi. I've been hearing about the devaluation of our currency being inevitable for complete replacement. I was wondering what will happen to our, my mortgage.
Yeah.
Will I be able to pay it off with the devalued currency?
You're doing that right now, Catherine. You're doing that right now. This is where long-term debtors are benefited by modest inflation. Because if your debt rate is fixed, if your mortgage rate is fixed, then every year as the value of the dollar drops by a half a percent or a percent or a percent and a half or whatever the inflation rate might be, 2-3% sometimes, then the dollars that you're using to pay off your mortgage are worth less than the dollars than the original valuation of the property. And it's one of the reasons why governments inflate currencies over time or devalue currencies over time, is so that they can incur debts in 1 year and then pay them off, you know, 10, 20 years later in dollars that are worth less or in whatever their currency may be. So the answer is yes. I don't think that, you know, there's going to be any, I don't think we're going to, you know, reissue dollars like Israel did with the shekel back in the late 70s, early 80s, where they replaced, 100 shekels with a 10 shekel bill, or Russia did with the ruble. And numerous countries have done this with their currency. I don't think the U.S. dollar is going to go through that. We'd have to have inflation that adds at least another zero to our dollars. But I don't see a big currency crisis. What I see coming is a banking crisis and a stock market crisis and a housing bubble crisis, basically a deflationary crisis. And in a deflationary crisis, money becomes more valuable. The value of the currency goes up. And that's a very dangerous thing. When the value of the currency goes up rapidly, in other words, you have deflation instead of inflation, then basically whoever has cash ends up winning. And then you're paying your mortgage off with dollars that are worth more than when you borrowed the money and bought the house. And that's a bad situation to be in. So and it completely upends the economic order. So, let's hope that doesn't happen. Catherine, thank you for the call. Let's hope that doesn't happen, but keep an eye out. I mean, you know, when a deflationary crash comes, that's a good time to either be in debt up to one's eyeballs that can be repudiated. In other words, be prepared to declare bankruptcy and walk away from all that debt. Or to be completely debt-free, have everything paid off, and have some cash, because cash is king during a deflationary crisis. And if you're invested, to be invested in bonds.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here, back from vacation, rested and ready to go. And I did finish a novel while we were down there. It's going to come out this fall. It's called Death in the Pines. It's an Oakley Tyler novel. He's a character I've written five novels about, none of which have been published before. This is the fifth in the series, and it'll be published first. The other four were practice. So, and I actually started writing them back in the early 80s. So, but the very first one is like really, I mean, it goes back, it takes place in East Berlin, you know. I mean, it's like, anyway. The libertarian experiment has now officially failed in Chile, the country of Chile, the South American country. The Chileans have now once and for all said, see you later, sayonara, hasta la vista, baby, to the religion of Reaganomics. Because tomorrow, Michelle Bachelet, an open socialist, is going to take office as the president of Chile. This is a big deal for her. It's a great personal achievement. She was president before, from 2006 to 2010, a 1 4-year term. But Chile's constitution says that a president can't serve more than one term. So she couldn't run in 2009. And so this guy, Sebastian Piñera, won, and he's actually a right winger. So Bachelet now gets this rare opportunity to be president twice in two different times. The only time this has happened in the United States, by the way, was when Grover Cleveland got reelected after, you know, he was elected and then he left office and was replaced by a Republican. And he was the only Democrat actually to be elected in the last half of the 19th century. And he was elected twice. So, but anyhow, but for Chileans, Bachelet's inauguration is about more than just, you know, personal glory. It's about finally putting to rest this brutal legacy of General Augusto Pinochet. Pinochet, you know, well, it's putting to rest his Chicago school economics. You know, I pointed this out back in December when Bachelet was first elected back, you know, just to go back into the story. In the early 70s, Chile was one of the most progressive countries in South America. The democratically elected socialist president, Salvador Allende, had nationalized big business, gave every Chilean access to free health care, free higher education, GDP went up, income inequality went down, life was good. But not everybody was happy with President Allende's 1970s Chilean version of the New Deal. Behind his back, the Nixon administration and the fat cats in the military and the corporate fat cats in Chile, the billionaires, basically, were conspiring to sabotage his reforms and to destroy his economy. Now, when he took over, he had a country that was already kind of a basket case. They needed some foreign loans to survive. And so Nixon got the IMF to say, no, we won't loan you the money. That decimated his economy. It stunted the progress he'd made over the first few years in office. And this U.S.-backed sabotage campaign turned into outright treason on September 11th. Yep, 9/11, 1973. When, with CIA help and corporate help, General Augusto Pinochet overthrew Allende's government and ushered in 17 years of military rule. During those 17 years, from 73 to 80, Pinochet's dictatorship was one of the most vicious in the history of Latin America. They jailed people, they tortured people, they killed people, they threw people out of helicopters into the ocean, the death squads took people into the National Soccer Stadium in Santiago, where they were killed by firing squads. In fact, people have such a strong memory of this time that a lot of Chileans refuse to watch soccer matches in the National Stadium because they don't want to dishonor the general's victims, the people who were murdered there. And, of course, he didn't just use the government to silence dissent. The whole point of the coup in the first place was to protect the economic interests of the Chilean elite, to protect them from Salvador Allende's socialism. And so, hey, you're going to protect rich people? Who do you turn to? Milton Friedman. He literally brought Milton Friedman down to Chile, along with a bunch of his Chicago boys. They called them the Chicago School Boys. And the Chicago School Boys slashed government spending, privatized industries, and started harsh austerity measures. They did exactly what Paul Ryan says we should do. Privatize Social Security. It was a disaster. In the crash of 2016, I wrote about this, and here's what I had to say. Inflation reached as high as 341%. GDP decreased by 15%. Chile's trade deficit ballooned a whopping $280 million. Unemployment went from 3% to 10%, and in some parts of the country climbed as high as 22%. So by 1990, Chile had returned to democracy, and Pinochet's experiment with libertarian economics was just a lasting but painful memory. But inequality was still high. Many Chileans don't have access to affordable education. And that's why the presidency of Michelle Bachelet is so important. She lived through the Pinochet regime. She was actually detained and tortured in the 1970s. She saw firsthand the damage that Pinochet and Milton Friedman and his libertarian buddies did to Chile, and now she wants to change it. She is saying healthcare and education should be rights, not privileges. She wants to raise taxes on the rich, and she wants to make education and healthcare free for all. I mean, this is a big deal. A BFD, as they say. In fact, the Washington Post over the weekend published an interview with Michelle Bachelet, Chile's incoming president. And let me just give you some quotes from her. They said, "You want to change the electoral system?" She said, "There's no other place in the world where a system like this exists that does not truly represent what the majority of the people want." Well, actually, Michelle, there is. It's here in the United States. Anyhow, she said, "We need to go to a different kind of electoral system. Also, we need to ensure that women and men have the same salaries." Whoa! "You want that in the Constitution?" She says, "Yes, we need to ensure that the Constitution is written so there's no possibility to discriminate against women." She talks about, you know, what happened when she was when she was 21. And she says, "I was 21. What happened was the minute the Secret Service guys came to my home," this is under Pinochet, "telephone rang, it was my boyfriend. We had a special code to say danger, and so I told him. People who were leaving the country immediately started campaigning for us, and that's why I didn't disappear. We were expelled from the country. We went to Australia. My brother lived there, but I really needed to be a part of the fight for democracy." So she moved to East Germany. She said, "I moved to Germany because my political party was there, the Socialist Party. I lived in Potsdam. It was a good experience." She studied German. She was a medical student. She got married in Germany, came back with her mother, her son, and her husband. Had to study medicine all over again. Now she's a pediatrician. She says she's going to take the corporate tax from 20% up to 25%. She said, "Yes, the corporate tax. We're also going to fight strongly against tax evasion and loopholes. We're going to do a lot of things in terms of improving the capacity to collect taxes. And we're going to have green taxes. Whoever contaminates more has to pay more." Free education. She says, "In Chile, we feel there is the right to a free education and free health care. It is not left or right. People who define themselves as moderates and centrists feel that the right of education and health is something that should be the basis of our society." It's remarkable. They ask her, you know, "What's going on in Venezuela? Are you worried about that?" See, in Venezuela, you've got, you know, a very aggressive right-wing media that is trying to raise hell. So we'll see. We'll see how Bachelet does. She's 62. She's young. There's a lot that she can do. I wish you the very best. Michelle Bachelet, good luck. You become president tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the net of this, of course, is that, you know, she's repudiating Reaganomics. Maybe we should think about doing the same thing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ted in Hamburg, Michigan. Hey, Ted.
Hey,
thanks for watching
Tom,
Free Speech TV.
Doing?
I'm fine. By the way, I need to plug Free Speech TV is doing their fundraising drive right now. So not just you, Ted, but anybody who's watching us on Free Speech TV, think about now calling 877-378-8669. If you're listening on one of our Pacifica affiliates and they're in a fund drive, call them, whatever it may be. So, Ted, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, we're going into spring, and this is tornado season, and every year I get feeling really terrible because I think I've got an idea how we can stop tornadoes.
Okay.
A simple technique by shooting rockets, trailing wires into these giant supercells, and shorting the electricity that's up in the storm, shorting it to ground. There's something going on in the clouds that causes the electricity not to go to ground. These storms often will produce lots of lightning.
Yep.
But yet when you see a picture of a tornado, this giant storm, and there's no lightning, there's a lot of electricity up there. We can just take it out of there with rockets and wires. It's a simple idea. What do you think?
It's interesting. First of all, the thing that is preventing that electricity from hitting the ground is the insulating power of air. Air is a very, very good insulator, electrical insulator. So it's one of the reasons why high tension lines don't short out to each other, because they're separated by air. But, when the potential, when the electrical potential is great enough to break through the air, that's when you have something called lightning, which is the shorting out of that electrical charge. But I think you're missing, and I could be wrong on this. I don't claim to be an expert on this topic, but I did have some cursory study of it in school. I think you're mistaking cause for effect. What happens is that when you have rapid moving air systems, and particularly in the absence of a lot of moisture, but even with the presence of moisture, but particularly before the moisture comes, you have rapid moving air systems against each other where there's air moving in different directions. That produces friction. Friction produces static electricity, right? Because electrons get ripped out of their valence, the loose valence bonds that some electrons have in the air particles, in the air molecules, and that, you know, ionizes them. They acquire a charge, and eventually that charge reaches the point where it's capable of discharging through the air. And the reason why you see so much more lightning in a thunderstorm than you see on a clear day where there's still electrically charged air is because the moisture in the thunderstorm is conductive relative to the air. And so that's why you see that lightning inside the thunderstorm. With regard to lightning inside a tornado, I don't have any idea. But it's not the electrical charge that's driving the tornado. It's the difference in pressure, in air pressure, between the heart, the eye of the tornado, the center of the tornado, which is the lowest pressure point, and, you know, the outside diameter of the tornado and the air around it. So I don't see how shorting out the electricity is going to change that pressure dynamic. Do you?
Well, you know, Tom, when you talk about lightning, you're leaving one thing out that we've learned in the last 20 years, and that's direct electricity is coming from the sun. Free electrons are flowing into our outer atmosphere. Every time there's a sun flare, there's a flare-off, there's a piece
sure.
of that energy. And this energy is being deposited in the upper atmosphere. And when you Google a thing like, where does lightning come from? Nobody in any of their elegant and very long explanations of where lightning, similar to what you just said, never mention the sun.
Interesting. So you think it's the ions from the sun that are... That's very interesting. Ted, I'm going to ponder that one. Thanks for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland, listening on TuneIn Radio. Joe, you wanted to disagree with me about Christianity?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Your response has often been with respect to libertarians, how, you know, some claim to be Christian, but the implication you give is that the libertarian philosophy is anti-Christian.
Oh, it's inconsistent with Christianity.
Well, it's not at all inconsistent with Christianity. You know, when the Good Samaritan was praised by Jesus for helping out a person along the road, he wasn't praised because the Good Samaritan went over to a rich person and forced the rich person to help him. The Good Samaritan was praised because he did so on his own without government action. You can't say, there is not one site in the New Testament at all that says the government should come in and redistribute wealth. The renders to Caesar, what is Caesar to Caesar, does not stand for that at all.
There actually is.
No, there isn't.
Yes, there is. Do you have a Bible?
Yeah.
Okay. Look up Matthew 25 and scroll down to the last roughly third. I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to have to rely on you. But you know the riff I'm talking about, right? Where he says in the final days I'll be sitting judging, and you know the lambs and the sheep.
I was in prison and you visited me.
Right.
Not, and all
right.
That
all that stuff. Right. Read me the first. Read me the first sentence of that part of Matthew 25.
Okay, hang on. Thanks. If you got the time. Like the virgin took.
Matthew 25 is a rather long chapter, so it takes a minute to scroll through it. But it's down toward about two-thirds of the way through, as I recall. And in fact, in some Bibles, they even break it up by saying, you know, the parable of the lambs and sheep and the stuff like that.
Okay, and this is when they separate the sheep and the goats.
Yes, right.
Sheep on his right hand, goats on the left.
That's right. So read me the very first sentence of that.
Yeah, then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come ye blessed of my father.
No, you're at the very end. I'm talking about the setup where he starts telling the story, the very first sentence.
Of the chapter?
No, of that basically verse, of that story, where he's talking about...
Before him shall be gathered all nations, and
there you go.
He shall separate them one from another, as shepherds divide in sheep from the goats.
Right. Okay, now let me just set this up for you. When Jesus says nations, he's talking about nations, not individuals. He's talking about governments. Nations are governments. So he's saying, we're going to decide which countries, which governments behaved well and which didn't. Read me that sentence again.
That is not at all the general understanding of what that means there. He means
my interpretation is not inconsistent with Catholic doctrine. In fact, my interpretation is what the Catholic Church stood on for over 800 years as the rationale for them being a nation state when they conquered and controlled most of Europe.
Well, okay, so you're in support then of the Spanish Inquisition and everything else?
I'm not in support of any of that stuff. I'm simply saying that for you to say that nobody would ever think that, you know, in the probably the most seminal piece of the New Testament, the grandest of the grand commissions, where Jesus says, you know, no way are you going to get into heaven unless you have fed the poor, fed the hungry, given water.
They are all individual mandates.
No, they are not.
If you go back to the Greek, it means peoples. It doesn't mean nation states. So therefore,
what does it say? Read it. It says nations.
No, but he. That's the one pair.
That's the setup. He says, in the last days, the nations are going to be in front of me, and I'm going to be picking left from right, goats and sheep, hell to heaven.
Okay,
all I'm saying, I'm not trying to preach Christianity here, Joe, but when you say, or anybody says, there's no place in the Bible where Jesus says that, you know, we should redistribute your wealth, that the government should be engaged in do-gooding, I'm saying, look at Matthew 25, penultimate.
Is your interpretation of that verse that unless you vote for a politician that wants to redistribute wealth, you are sinning?
No.
Okay. Well, it has to be if that's what you think that verse means.
Well, my interpretation of that verse is pretty straightforward. That what he is saying is that in the last days, you know, what you can believe it or not, this has to do with how you believe, you know, all this stuff plays out. But basically, in the last days, he's going to judge the nations of the world. And you know, the nation of Israel was a big deal throughout the Bible. The coherence and cohesiveness of the people. And you can go back into the Old Testament and look at the injunction for Jubilee. I mean, is it Deuteronomy or Leviticus? Read some of Isaiah. Go, you know, I mean, there's some remarkable stuff in there about the people collectively operating in a way that's either good or evil. And I think that there's a big lesson for us all in that. Now, I'm not going to try to interpret that down to the micro. I'm not a theologian, or at least in this current moment in my life, I'm not. And I don't make, I don't want to make any claims to be speaking on behalf of the Bible or religion or anything. You know, I can speak for myself. That's it. But I do know that not only does Matthew 25 set it up as the nations are going to be judged, but that the Catholic Church, as I said, used that and other places throughout the Old Testament where it appears frequently, incredibly frequently, as the rationale. And I, to the best of my knowledge, they've never repudiated it. And the Catholic Church is the largest faction within Christianity, to as the rationale for the government being run in a way that presumably benefits the people.
Are you going to let a rebuttal or no?
Yeah, well, you got a half a minute. It's yours.
Okay. First of all, in order for you to believe that, for you to like cite the Catholic Church of 100 years ago or 200 years ago is silly, because you, I'm sure you disagree with almost everything else the Catholic Church.
No, it's the Catholic Church is still a nation state. I think they're still using that rationale.
Well, fine. Maybe
they have a seat
wrong.
At the United Nations.
But where? So you're saying you have to say that it is a sin to vote for a Republican?
No, you're drawing an inference. I wouldn't vote for anybody who was.
It's a mandate. So when you say judge.
Why? Okay, Joe, I'll give you that. I personally take it that way. I personally take that as my and my nation's mandate. I do. Joe, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
No, we're going to leave religion and get back to politics, right? In fact, I want to get the science. Gluten? Really? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very myoxenally ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Neil deGrasse Tyson. During an appearance on CNN's Reliable Sources yesterday, the astrophysicist and host of the new show Cosmos on Fox criticized how much coverage the mainstream media gives to climate change deniers.
Yeah, I think the media has to sort of come out of this ethos that I think was in principle a good one, but it doesn't really apply in science. The ethos was whatever story you give, you have to give the opposing view, and then you could be viewed as balanced. In the clip that you showed of the president, you don't talk about the spherical Earth with NASA in it and then say, oh, now let's give equal time to the flat earthers. Plus, science is not there for you to cherry pick. You know, I said this once, and it's gotten a lot of internet play. I said the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it.
I couldn't agree more. It's time for the media to stop this false balance act and start portraying climate change deniers for what they are: fringe wackos who are often paid hands of the fossil fuel industry. The bad, Pat Garofalo, the Minnesota state representative, is under fire today for sending out an incredibly offensive tweet. At 7:33 p.m. Sunday night, Garofalo quipped, "Let's be honest, 70% of teams in the NBA could fold tomorrow and nobody would notice a difference, with the possible exception of an increase in street crime." Garofalo has since tried to qualify his comments by saying that he was just making an observation based on the NBA's high arrest rate. But let's be honest, nothing is going to make that tweet look any better. And the very, very ugly, the arms room. The Florida Gun Shop had a special guest for its Saturday gun show, George Zimmerman. Yes, that George Zimmerman. He told Fox 35 News in Orlando that while he was concerned for his safety, he was happy to have a chance to meet with his supporters. Remember, Zimmerman is famous for one reason and one reason alone: shooting and killing a 17-year-old African-American kid. The fact that the arms room tried to promote him as some sort of celebrity at a gun show, no less, is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Huh? Glue? Oh, gluten! Yes, I was going to mention gluten. This is a very, very interesting paper. This was written by Ari Laveau. It's an interview with Stephanie Seneff, a senior research scientist over at MIT. And he asked her, you know, what is it that causes gluten sensitivity? Gluten is a protein in wheat. Well, it's in wheat, barley, rye. I think there's small amounts of it in oats and spelt, but it's basically wheat, barley, and rye are the principle. And I am highly gluten intolerant. I you know, just a teaspoon of soy sauce, which is made actually out of wheat. It's not made out of soy, is enough the response I get to gluten is the same response people normally get to food poisoning. You know, it's like you have to lock yourself in the restroom for the next few hours. And it ain't good. And a lot of people have this. And an increasing number of people have this. It's like an explosion. You know, what's going on with this? So Stephanie Senth says, we have argued in the paper that glyphosate, glyphosate, which, by the way, is the chemical name for a product which is sold under the brand name of Roundup by Monsanto. Glyphosate binds to gluten. Gluten usually forms cross-mesh connections between different amino acids, and glyphosate would disrupt that because it would prevent the cross-mesh by binding to the gluten and causing the gluten to stay in the form that is known to be more allergenic. So we believe glyphosate causes the gluten to assume a form that is more allergenic. So how does Roundup get onto wheat? Well, it turns out that the 3 or 4 days before they harvest wheat, they soak it. They soak the wheat plants with glyphosate, with Roundup, to kill the plants. Now, why do they do that? Because then the dead plants, they still have the wheat heads, the wheat berries at the top, but the dead plants then become stiffer, more rigid. And so when you come through with the threshing machine, the combine, it more easily snaps these plants off. It, like, you know, it makes farming easier. It's good for industrial agriculture. And then they say, well, is there any evidence of this? And she says, one thing we see certainly in Sri Lanka and El Salvador is agricultural workers who are working in sugarcane fields that are sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest, just as wheat is. These workers are dying at a young age from kidney failure. And people with celiac disease are at a high risk for kidney failure. And you can see how glyphosate would kill a kidney because you get an overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria that produce picrosol, which is very toxic to the kidney. And she says now Sri Lanka and El Salvador have both within the last year decided to ban glyphosate usage on their farms because of what they're seeing happening to these agricultural workers. Amazing. So I'm not willing to do the experiment on having some organically grown wheat to find out if that doesn't bother me, but you know, somebody who's like maybe just moderately gluten intolerant might be an interesting thing to explore. Larry in Nutley, New Jersey, listening on WBAI, you wanted to give us an update on what's going on with Rutgers University inviting Condi Rice to speak, and now their professor's saying, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, and also thanks for the information on kidney failures in El Salvador. That's something I've been following for a while, and it's good to know that there's finally some answer coming out about that.
Well, it's not a certainty. It's she's doing statistical analysis, so it's a probability, but not a certainty.
Well, it's good that there's a lead.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so you've heard that the faculty is against it, but on Friday, President Barchi came out and issued a very weak response to the faculty and the complaints that people like myself and other alumni and members of the community have been giving, basically saying, you know, we can't always have consensus and even unpopular views need to speak, ignoring the fact that Condi Rice isn't somebody who's being oppressed, but it's being turned into that these are these in horrible liberals who are, you know, so many comments are being made. Oh, it's because she's black. You're afraid of a strong black woman.
No, I think we're afraid of a war criminal, aren't we?
Yeah. There's been this question that's been asked rhetorically. And I actually gave an answer to this to the Home News, the Gannett paper, which they didn't print. They printed that the reporter said, that this is politically motivated. And I told them right from the get-go, you know, this has nothing to do with partisan politics. People have been asking, would I oppose somebody in the Obama administration being honored, such as Hillary Clinton or Bob Kerry or John Kerry?
Right.
And my answer is, those that are involved in the drone assassination program, yes, I would oppose them being honored with an honorary degree at Rutgers.
Yeah. I mean, it's you just have to call them as you see them. And I'm with you. The Bush administration, this administration, yes, Obama has radically scaled back on that and put some sort of a a fig leaf of due process, but I still think that we as a country are committing something that is either war crimes or just a crime. Execution without judicial review is unconstitutional, at the very least, and a violation, I believe, of international law. Larry, thank you for the call, and good luck. Good luck. Keep the fight going. And thanks for listening to WBAI. Chris, listening on KKZN in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Tom? I've been meaning to ask you this for a while now. When I was living in Denver, now I'm living in the Seattle area, where and they do have high occupancy vehicle lanes. And I know you've kind of riffed on it with a couple people from the Reason Foundation about how, it seems like you're not really in favor of these HOV lanes. And I really aren't either. And because of this particular reason, I mean, I can be going down I-405 here in Seattle and, on my way home from work, and I'll see, on these HOV lanes, for people that don't know that live in states without them, you have to have, two or more people, in some instances, at least three people. They're carpool lanes. And I see people, particularly in BMWs. BMW drivers seem to be the worst offender of this, but they'll be single occupant BMW drivers going down the HOV lane and not really caring. I mean, in the times that they do get caught, I kind of thought to myself, hey, if you're driving a BMW, $50,000 car, and if you're going to get a ticket going down the HOV lane at, $100 and $120, I mean, you're just going to pay it.
So it becomes a cost of doing business. Yeah, it's the same.
Right.
It's the same attitude these big corporations have. Yeah, sure, we'll pump out some toxin laced food or whatever, and some people will die. But it's just going to be cost of business. We'll get through that one.
So, in your view, should we make fines progressive, just like we do taxes, just like in a lot of places in Europe, that's based on your income, or would that fall under the purview of equal protection under the Constitution?
I'm quite certain that if you tried to make fines for things like HOV lane violations based on somebody's income or somebody's wealth, that you would have a challenge under the 14th Amendment, that's not equal protection under the law, and that it would almost certainly prevail in the Supreme Court. It is done, and you're correct. I believe Denmark, Finland, several of the Scandinavian countries have fines for public behaviors that increase if you're rich. But I don't think that we could ever successfully do that in the United States. I'm not sure it's all that desirable. Why not just raise the fine threshold? Why not make it a $1,000 fine? Or put it at the... Here's a way to do it that actually would be constitutional. Put it at the discretion of the judge with a range. The fine is $100 to $5,000 and, one day to 6 months in jail. And just let the judge decide how egregious it is. And one of the factors that he or she might take into consideration is the ability of the person to pay the fine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Fifteen minutes before the hour, and Billy in Wimberley, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm well. It says you're Catholic.
Listen, man,
and you don't want to hear me preach.
I always get tickled when I hear left-wingers talking about the Bible and Christ and how they're Christians.
Uh-huh.
I just don't get it, how you can take the position you take on things like abortion and then try to preach somebody what Matthew means.
Well, what do you know about my position
really
on abortion?
About your interpretation of the Bible.
The Bible
does preach that Christ favored charity, and the least of those, you treat well. You treat me the same way. I believe that, and I live that in my life.
And that He would judge the nations at the end times.
Any place.
Well,
in the Bible.
Go read Matthew 25.
I'm sorry.
Go read Matthew 25.
Well, that doesn't say anything about redistribution of wealth to me.
How could it not be? A nation that feeds the hungry among it is a good nation that's going to do well, and a nation that refuses to feed the hungry among it is going to hell. I mean, Jesus comes right out and says it.
There's a difference between that. This country feeds the hungry. It always has.
No, we don't.
There's a huge difference between that and a progressive tax system that penalizes people for going out and becoming entrepreneurs or becoming successful. a progressive tax system is on its face immoral.
There, no, I you know, I strongly disagree, and I think that I could find biblical basis for it. But
well, you're welcome.
What,
to, but
I'm curious what you know.
But it's you know, you're a false prophet, man. How do you stand on abortion?
John 4. You don't know my position on abortion.
No, that's why I'm asking you.
My position on abortion is my position. I'm strongly of the opinion that if we are going to have laws passed about abortion, that they should be passed by women, that only women should be allowed to vote on issues that have to do with abortion, because I can never experience an abortion. I'm never going to have to face that horrible choice.
That sounds very, very... That sounds really good, except for the fact that abortions affect male babies, too, and they affect fathers, too. Yes, the woman has the greater burden when it comes to a pregnancy. There's never been any question about that.
So the woman should have a greater say.
Unabridged or unfettered abortion as a form of birth control is wrong.
See, Billy, if you want the height of hypocrisy is two men arguing about abortion.
That's ridiculous.
I've never seen two women sitting around, you know, arguing about, vasectomies.
That's ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous? You're never going to have an abortion. I'm never going to have an abortion.
It's right out there for us to see. And for to use abortion as a form of birth control is wrong. And I can't see how anybody doesn't see that. You know, when we talk about when we want to
Billy, you're entitled to your opinion, but
abortion,
you know,
which is nothing less than murder, and you want to equate that with us.
Okay, so let me get this straight.
Right to choose.
If it's wrong. We're out of time. Okay, Billy, thanks for the call. I guess I've said what I had to say. An abortion is enough. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. She's going to give us the news of the day. I look forward to it. Okay, stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News, Victoria Jones, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hello, Victoria. Nice to see your smiling face again.
Hey, Tom.
And to hear your smiling voice. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And what is the state of the world today?
Oh, you know.
Okay, so what's in the news?
Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor, spoke to the SXSW, which I'm always afraid
South by Southwest. Just call it South by Southwest.
It's a question of mispronouncing the letters, because you can really mess up on that. Pekka Music Conference today via satellite from Russia, and said some very interesting things. It was a panel moderated by the ACLU on privacy and technology. And he was asked whether he would leak again, and he said, absolutely yes. He said, I saw that the Constitution was violated on a massive scale. The interpretation of the Fourth Amendment has been changed. Thank you. There was a lot of applause.
Yeah, I can imagine.
During all this. The interpretation of the Constitution has been changed in secret from no unreasonable search and seizure to, hey, any seizure is fine, just don't search it. And that's something the public ought to know.
That's, and he's right. Did he say he would, as in
yes.
I would do it again, or I will,
absolutely.
That he will do it again?
So he was, well...
Because he still has material that has not made it to the press.
Right. No. Well, he says they're in the hands of journalists, basically.
Okay, so he handed it all off to Glenn Greenwald,
right.
and
so
that's...
he's saying whether he would do it again. He also said, he said some other very interesting things. He called out the FISA court for interpreting law in secret. He said they shouldn't be interpreting the Constitution when only the NSA's lawyers are making the case. He also called out NSA Director Keith Alexander and former NSA Director Michael Hayden, saying the two of them harmed Internet security and national security far more than anything he's done. He also said that this focus on metadata and all this kind of stuff, and this lack of focus on collecting everyone's data has caused us to mislead. He highlighted Tamerlan Sarnaev, the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, and Umar Farooq Abdulmutallab, the Christmas Day underwear attempted bomber, as examples of misintelligence. He also advocated strongly for encryption, saying repeatedly, encryption works, and calling it defense against the dark arts for the digital realm.
Wow, that's extraordinary. We just shifted over to your Skype audio because it sounds better than your telephone audio. Your phone has fallen apart.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
So you can continue to listen to me on the phone, I suppose. But
okay.
So, wow, that's a pretty – yeah. And I saw his thing about, you know, encryption works. Yeah, I think you just said that. Yeah.
He said one other thing also. When he spoke to the audience, he called on tech developers around the world to protect people's rights. He said they are, referring to the NSA, setting fire to the future of the Internet. And the people who are in this room now, you guys are all the firefighters, and we need you to help us fix this.
Wow. That's pretty impressive stuff.
It was very interesting. Very interesting indeed.
What's the story on the 28 Democrats who are going to hold an all-night filibuster tonight to wake up about climate change?
Well, it's not quite a filibuster because they're not filibustering anything.
Right.
There's no legislation on the floor. It is, in fact, a talkathon. It's done by the Senate Climate Action Task Force. It's expected to draw 28 Senate Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Dick Durbin, Barbara Boxer, Sheldon Whitehouse, many others. And basically, they say it could wake up colleagues still skeptical about climate change science. Barbara Boxer said in the statement, the purpose is to use the bully pulpit of our Senate offices to achieve that wake-up call. We believe that climate change is a catastrophe that's unfolding before our eyes, and we want Congress to take off the blindfolds. And the White House said, Jay Carney said today at the briefing that I was at, that it absolutely supported the plans to hold the all-night talkathon. We commend those who are participating because it's a very important subject that the president, as you know, is concerned about and has a climate action plan dedicated to addressing.
Wow, that's impressive. What else is up?
Another thing that is up. This is kind of interesting. On the Malaysian appeared over the sea, investigators in Malaysia are voicing skepticism that it was a target of an attack, according to U.S. and European government sources close to the probe. Now, they haven't ruled out the possibility that militants were involved in downing the aircraft, but they're saying that the evidence doesn't strongly back an attack. One U.S. source said one of the main reasons that they're leaning away from an attack is because electronic evidence indicates it may have made a turn back towards Kuala Lumpur before it disappeared. But even that information hasn't been confirmed. And basically, the whole thing is a complete mystery.
Right.
Every lead has gone wrong.
Well, and in fact, if the plane disintegrated in the air and for some short period of time there was still some electrical service, but the plane lost power, if the air current that they were flying into was blowing back against them, you would have the apparent turn, but it would just be basically a debris field being blown back.
Right.
So who knows? I mean,
that's even more confusing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Attorney General Eric Holder said today that the increase in heroin-related deaths was an urgent and growing public health crisis. He also said first responders should carry with them a drug that can reverse the effects of an overdose.
Yeah, naloxone.
Right. He made a video message.
There are actually Republicans who are trying to pass laws forbidding first responders and anybody else from having naloxone because they say it encourages people to use heroin.
That's unfortunate. But there are also states that are doing the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems to be a mixture.
Yeah. Yes.
For example, some states, Utah, Ohio, and Tennessee are passing laws to increase access to naloxone.
Yeah, which I think is a really good thing. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. We'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman Program right after this.
listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And over the last week, Louise and I were down in Mexico on a family reunion slash vacation thing. And so I kind of missed out on a lot of weird activity going on here in the United States. And I wanted to catch up. And I'd also, while I was down there, been able to read things on the Internet and watch international television. And oddly enough, Fox and CNN play in Mexico, and saw Steve Cohen being interviewed more than once, and just wanted to reconnect. Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus, New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. The website for The Nation, of course, is thenation.com. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thank you, but had I your leisure life, I too would have gone home to a reunion, but in Kentucky.
Aha!
But I'm stuck here in New York.
Yeah, well, we're originally from Michigan, but this is my sister-in-law's idea, and it was our first vacation in 10 years.
Okay.
Louise and I, so.
That's not good. Might take my vacation in Moscow and Kentucky.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
All right.
So your thoughts on what the current state of affairs is between, There's two dynamics that I'm concerned about, and I'd love to get your take on. One is the dynamic between Russia, Ukraine, and Crimea, and the other is the dynamic between the administration, the Obama administration, and the Putin administration.
Right. They're connected, of course.
Yes.
Let me say something about, I think you said on the air that you'd seen me on Fox News, and you were a little surprised. It was a straight news show. And I'm not welcome everywhere, but I believe that we could be in the run-up to war. And there's only a handful of people, such as myself, who are trying to give a somewhat different perspective on this Ukrainian crisis, which has been unfolding since November, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. So whoever asked me, would you come and say what you think? And I say, if you don't shout at me and you don't call me a Putin apologist, I think it's my duty to give my perspective.
Sure.
A few more people are coming out, but a lot of people have been in the closet on this one.
Yeah. Well, I saw you on CNN, too. I mean,
let me give you today's news.
Okay.
Because I think it goes to your question.
Yeah.
I said on CNN, on Fareed Zakaria's show yesterday, that I thought we were three steps from actual war with Russia for the first time in history. Two steps from something older listeners will remember as the Cuban Missile Crisis of the early 60s. And then from there, it's one step to war. What are the two steps to the Cuban Missile Crisis? It is the following. It's being argued in Europe and in Washington by the War Party that we, the West, immediately move NATO troops to the Polish-West Ukrainian border. So far as I know, they're not proposing moving NATO troops into Ukraine in the West. You know, the West is pro-West, so
right. The
country's geographically and politically divided. You've got a lot of people running around saying that isn't so, but they're just giving a fig to the disaster of Western policy. It's a divided country, and nobody should have ever asked them to choose. If these people, and these are people I don't know that, you know, whether I can't remember because they talk all the time, but people like McCain and the War Party here, and they're the same people who are in Brussels in the European Union, move NATO troops, NATO troops to the border of Western Ukraine. Remember, Poland is in NATO, so legally they could do that. What would Putin do? I believe, you remember last week, he practiced, exercised 150,000 troops. Had nothing to do with Crimea, in the sense that those troops didn't go to Crimea. And he sent them back to their bases in Russia. He would send those troops into southern and eastern Ukraine. Then we'd have the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
And then we'd be one step from war. There's two pieces of bad news today. Excuse me. It is reported out of the Russian news agencies, and they don't usually lie. They put spins on stories, but the facts they get straight. That NATO warplanes are landing in Poland and Romania. I don't know why. Is it symbolic? Are they there on a vacation? Or are they preparation for troop movement because troops need air cover? I don't know. The second piece of news is also reported out of Russia, but I believe it to be true. Kerry, our Secretary of State, was supposed to go to Moscow either tomorrow or the next day to meet with the Foreign Minister of Russia, Lavrov. Presumably, he also would see Putin. That would have been a good thing. As Churchill said, better to talk, talk, talk than fight, fight, fight. Kerry canceled his visit today. Now, the reason he gave wasn't terrible. He said he needed more time to prepare some documents. Fair enough. But he ended by saying that if Putin doesn't step back from Ukraine, there is nothing left to discuss at all. What in the world does that mean?
That's
it has two meanings. It means we're not talking. We're arming and we're mobilizing. I don't know what it means, but I'll tell you one thing. The Russians don't like public threats, and Putin in particular, not from Secretary of State or Kerry or the White House. And therefore, they are going to put the worst personal interpretation on what Kerry said. So that's where we stand as we talk.
Wow. Now, my...
You probably want to go back to New Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Tell me something. When I grew up in Kentucky, we had those yellow nuclear fallout shelters.
Right.
Are you too young to remember those?
No, I was born in 51. I remember it well. I did duck and cover in elementary
Absolutely.
School.
We got
in
our wooden school chairs and put our hands over our head, and
yep.
we were going to be okay. Well, I said to my wife, I mean, maybe we should go down to Kentucky and see if my dad's nuclear fallout shelter is still on the property down there.
Yeah, my dad actually at one point talked. We had a basement in our house in Michigan, and he was talking about putting a plywood floor above it and putting enough dirt on it. Apparently dirt insulates from radiation. I mean, everybody was terrified.
It was a wonderfully innocent time.
It was in some ways, yeah.
I think you can run from radiation poisoning.
Right, exactly. Question.
Yep.
We might be, I mean, we're threatening to cite troops in Poland.
We're not threatening. It's being discussed and proposed publicly.
Right.
I don't know that threat. Now, privately, we, and I don't mean me or you, but the White House in Brussels. So I think this is now in the hands. You know, remember that Obama farmed the whole Ukrainian question out to the European Union.
Right.
They completely screwed it up. They won't admit it. They're just blaming Putin. But now the White House has to take it over. So if the White House is talking about this, moving NATO troops to the border of Ukraine, and I would guess they are. Nonetheless, they aren't saying it publicly. Now, whether they threaten Russia, I don't know.
But Professor Cohen, when the Soviet Union dissolved, my recollection is that Mikhail Gorbachev made a deal with George Herbert Walker Bush that NATO would not solicit Poland. And
that's true.
And I believe that Bill Clinton broke that deal.
No, it was worse than that. What Baker said, he was the first George Bush's Secretary of State.
Right.
And the issue was the reunification of Germany. This was 1990-91, because divided Germany was the epicenter of that Cold War. Everybody wanted to reunite Germany, even Gorbachev. But it was a tough sell in Russia, where the Soviet Union had lost almost 27 million people in the war against Germany in 1941-45. Gorbachev told them, I've got to take something home. What about NATO? And they said, we've got to unite NATO. NATO, but what about Germany? Is Germany going to be in NATO? And the West said, we've got to do that. There's no way to have, if we reunite Germany, the whole of Germany has to be in NATO. And what then? And Baker said, and the German foreign minister was there, and so was Condi Rice, who wrote it in her book before she became a mucky muck, before she became Secretary of State. Baker said, we will not move NATO one inch to the east. Today, NATO is on Russia's borders in the Baltics.
Right, which they have to view with a jaundiced eye. We'll be back. We have you for the half hour, correct, sir?
How long do you want me?
Another 15 minutes, if we can?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen, will be right back with us. TheNation.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What is going on in Ukraine? And what could it mean to the United States? More after this. Welcome back. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, and TheNation.com for his most recent piece. Professor Cohen, I wrote a book recently called The Crash of 2016, which was really sort of an analysis of how the Powell Doctrine has played out in the United States, the Powell Memo. But one of the things that had been brought to my attention that I included in the book was that roughly every 80 years we experience this cycle. And it's basically we learn a horrible lesson, we stay smart for 60 years, then the people who were young when that lesson was learned start dying off, and we get stupid again for 20 years, repeat the mistake, and it starts all over again. And so 80 years ago, we had the Great Depression followed by World War II. 80 years before that, we had the Great Depression of 1856 followed by the Civil War. 80 years before that, there was the Great Crash of 1770 followed by the American Revolution. And you can keep going in these 80-year cycles all the way back to the War of the Roses. This is something that Howe and Strauss really go into a lot of detail about in their book, The Fourth Turning. And in my book, I was suggesting, you know, this crash could very easily lead to war because they always have in the past. And, you know, kind of military gaming or mind gaming scenarios. What do you think about that? As, you know, the world is in a horrible situation economically. War seems to benefit the elites at the very least and ultimately puts back together economies. Or is that just totally crazy stuff?
Well, it's obviously not totally crazy. You probably have to factor in expanded life expectancy of generations now.
Right.
Because, you know, the wise people die, used to die at 60, now they die in their 80s. So that might fit your cycle.
Yeah.
I resist because it lets our leadership and our elites off the hook that somehow things are predetermined by anything.
Mm-hmm.
What we have in the Ukrainian crisis is a classic example of the collapse of political leadership and elite-making policy. There are people who blame the American and the Russian people. None I've ever met want this, but the elites want it for their own reasons, whether it's mendacity, whether it's stupidity, whether it's greed, whether it's power, I don't know, but it's too late to sit down and figure out how they led us to this. The question is there a way out? There is a way out. There's a way out of the war danger. There's a way to creatively eliminate this crisis and maybe create a stable Ukraine, which is the buffer between Russia and the West. The question is, where is the leadership? We have demonized Putin to the extent that he has no legitimacy in the United States. Henry Kissinger wrote in the Washington Post, I think on March 3rd, as a kind of memo to Obama, demonizing Putin is not a policy. It's an alibi for not having a policy. I would just amend that to say it's an alibi for having a wrong-headed policy for 20 years since, to return to your earlier point, we began breaking our promise to Russia to expand NATO to Russia's borders. If that continued, we were bound to come up into a war zone as we did in Georgia in 2008 and as we have today. The question is, where's the leadership?
Professor Stephen Cohen with us. We'll be right back with more with Professor Cohen. It's 20 minutes past the hour. You can read his writing most recently over at TheNation.com. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Stephen, Professor Stephen Cohen on the line with us, professor emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. You can read his most recent piece, Distorting Russia, over at thenation.com. Professor Cohen, arguably much of what we're seeing play out in Ukraine began with some sharpshooters on the top of buildings killing both police and protesters some weeks or months ago. And there have been claims and counterclaims that these shooters were there on behalf of the Ukrainian government, or they were there on behalf of, you know, extreme rightists, or maybe even, I mean, tomorrow Michelle Bachelet is installed as president in Chile, and there's some evidence that ITT, back in the day, you know, when Pinochet overthrew Allende, that there was murder of civilians that was to be blamed on the government that was actually funded by one of our corporations. And I noticed that back in November, one of our largest oil companies cut a multi-billion-dollar deal with the Ukrainian government for oil exploration.
For fracking.
Yeah, for fracking, exactly, because there's a lot of coal shale. So, you know, what's the latest state of the art of knowledge about who those shooters were, where they came from?
Let's say why it's important.
Yeah.
I'm not a conspiracy buff, but I believe that dark forces operate where we can't see them. The crisis began, to be clear about this, in November, when Europe unwisely imposed on a profoundly divided country, divided between Russia and the West, an ultimatum: join Europe's economic zone or join Russia's. What Europe should have done is what Putin proposed at that moment, but of course you can't defend Putin or you get Putin bashed the way I have been. He said, why is it either or? Why can't we both help Ukraine out of this crisis? And later we'll decide if membership in both zones, economic, is compatible. And that was rejected. That set off the crisis. Now, on February 21, the European ministers went to Kiev and they brokered a compromise. The president, which they recognized as, whom they recognized as legitimate, Yanukovych, signed with the opposition leaders an agreement for early presidential elections in December. And Yanukovych agreed to amnesty all of the people who had been arrested during the protest. And there were some other agreements. That might have been a way out, but it died the next day. And one reason it died is somebody was killing people in the streets from the top of buildings with high-power sniper rifles. It was said at the time that those belonged to the government of Ukraine. Yanukovych, a mob moved toward the presidential palace. He's a cowardly man, but he knew what happened to other leaders in such situations, and he fled to Russia. Putin is now saying that's where conversation should begin, on the agreement that Yanukovych signed, because he's the legitimately elected president of Ukraine, and that Europe signed off on. But you can't turn political history back. But it is important to know whose snipers there were, though they were. The Estonian prime minister, and there's no country in the world more anti-Russian than Estonia, told the foreign minister of the European Union that he was deeply worried because those snipers were not from Yanukovych. And he said he was worried that some of the protesters in the streets were behind those snipers. He didn't go on to add what he was thinking, that the protesters in the streets include a quasi-Nazi movement, a fascist movement that's long been in Ukraine, and which now has five members in the new Kiev government. That's alarming, to say the least. Whose snipers they were, I don't know. But you're right. That was a tipping point. That plunged us toward the war zone that I'm talking about. Because had the February 21 agreement held, it would be unstable, but everybody would be organizing to win the elections of December 2014, not arming themselves. And Putin would not have taken over Crimea.
So the day could come when we look back and say that was the Archduke Ferdinand moment?
That's right. And to include with your cycle of histories, everybody's pointing out we're on the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One, and that we stumbled into World War One. And are we stumbling into World War III now, with madness and mendacity and prejudice and an unwillingness to listen. Because what we have now, unless they're talking someplace quietly where we can't see them, the deaf talking to the deaf. Rhetoric is escalating in Moscow and in Washington. The clamor for war is growing. Now, a number of parties, but not the United States, has called for an investigation of that sniping incident because they agree that was the tipping point. But what if it turns out to have been done on the part of people who are now members of this government in Kiev, which we have embraced?
Right. You have to ask who benefited.
Well, if you went with who benefited, then the anti-Russian forces, the anti-Yanukovych forces benefited,
right?
Because when you shoot 80-some-odd people in the head, or the number wasn't that high, but when you shoot people dead in the streets from buildings, and if the finger points at the president, he had to flee.
Yep.
He had no choice. Once he fled, the Constitution was done. The extremists didn't come to power, but they came to power sharing. They're sharing power now. And Obama unwisely keeps declaring that the government in Kiev is legitimate, even though it overthrew the Constitution. It has no electoral basis in law or reality. Now, they're called elections for May, but are we going to get to May?
It's a good question. We only have about 20 seconds left. Do you think we're going to get to May?
You know, I'm a leadership guy, Tom. I mean, we need leadership. The key role here has to be played by Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, because Putin doesn't trust Obama. He trusts Merkel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she has, made noises that...
Well, she's in a vice. I mean, yeah. That's another program. Where is Germany in all this? It's terrible for her. We'll see. I mean, it's leadership. It's time to step up.
Yeah. Remarkable stuff. Professor Stephen Cohen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's a pleasure. You can check out his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War, his most recent piece for The Nation magazine, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresent Putin, Sochi, and Ukraine, at thenation.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and some of my thoughts on some of the news of the day and the Financial Times prediction of a bubble bursting. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, thought-provoking, sobering conversation with Professor Cohen. If NATO moves into Poland in a big way, you know, it's amazing. We were on this program just, what, 3-4 months ago? Over the course of actually several months, repeatedly, we kept having these conversations, you and I, about are we standing at the edge of World War I? And not even knowing exactly where it would be. Just, you know, hey, it's the 100th anniversary of World War I. We blundered into it. And World War I went from lighting a fuse to exploding, you know, a whole string of firecrackers. Probably a quite inadequate metaphor, but you get the point. It went from that as a consequence, you know, the string that tied all the firecrackers together were these mutual defense treaties that countries had with each other. And when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, it was, you know, well, okay, the you know, Serbia has now insulted the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they have an alliance with Germany, and Serbia has an alliance with Russia, and then on it goes, right? And pretty soon, the United States is in the middle of this thing. Not pretty soon. It took a couple of years. I mean, Woodrow Wilson really had to work his butt off to, you know, get his propaganda minister, Mr. Bernays, to get Americans on board with going to war. But that's how World War I happened. I mean, to this day, you won't find a historian who can say, here's a good reason why we went to war. And you have to ask yourself, could those shooters on the rooftop, could this be an Archduke Ferdinand moment? And if the United States were to go to war with Russia, would it be nuclear? I mean, we both have long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. They can go from continent to continent. Is that the direction we want to go? I mean, it seems to me that it is time to seriously wind down some of this rhetoric, some of this jingoism, which is being promoted by the president's political enemies, you know, the John McCain's, the Republican. Oh, you know, he was too weak. That's why I put, you know, come on. And the television networks that are like, oh, boy, war. We love war. We make a lot of money when there's war. Everybody watches TV. We can sell our ads for a whole lot more money. And let's just have a conversation about how many people are going to die in a war. I mean, we saw this gin up to war before Afghanistan. We saw this gin up to war before Iraq. We saw an attempt to gin up to war before the attempt to go into Syria and Iran. And President Putin and President Obama worked out a deal with Iran and with Syria to prevent war. I mean, how is that not a good thing? I'm just astounded by the whole thing. Stephen in New York, listening on WBAI. Hey, Stephen.
Hi there, Stephen.
Stephen, my apologies.
Professor Cohen's assessment of what time we are, I mean, you know, the 2 minutes to 12 sort of thing,
right,
is very worrisome. I disagree very much with his timeline of the events that have led to this. I'm not going to go into those. I just do want to update one, you know, scary little bit that he mentioned about NATO aircraft getting sent over to Poland. I was just online and saw a report from Euronews, which has multilingual reports. And the specific aircraft are AWACS, which is to say radar.
Oh, which you use to coordinate a war.
Well, but you also use to see what...
To spy.
The folks are, well, the, what the other folks are doing.
Right.
And so, to me, that's a sort of defensive thing. I think we would like to know what Russian forces might be doing.
But when we went to war with Iraq, I mean, one of the first things that went in there were the AWACS.
Well, but I'm giving the
most optimistic take on this.
Well, an optimistic take on it. I mean, if they had reported that AWACS plus fighter jets plus bombers had flown into Poland, that would be of concern. If they had reported that AWACS plus ground troops had gone into Poland, that would say something else.
Yeah. The other thing is that our largest military presence in Europe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this to be the case, is in Germany.
Well,
and if we were to...
It's always been in Germany.
Yeah, and if we were to start moving troops or military aircraft out of Germany without Angela Merkel's permission, all hell would break loose. And she is not going to go for that. I mean, I heard this morning, Pepsi, 7% of their worldwide sales are in Russia. You know, Russia has a stock exchange. Russia not so much Ukraine, but, you know, there's an enormous amount of economic intercourse between Europe and Russia. And, in fact...
I have strong disagreements with the overview that Professor Cohn has been giving for the last 3 or 4 weeks on especially progressive radio stations such as yours and Democracy Now. That's not to the point so much now, I believe. He is correct to say that I think the Western leadership, the EU response, particularly NATO spokespersons, and then all of President Obama's team, from Susan Rice to what's her name, who was in... the Ukraine,
right,
with the cookies, I forget her name, Victoria Nuland, and the president himself, have been drawing all these lines in the sand. If you do this, there are grave consequences. If you do this, there are other grave consequences. If you do this, we will do this. the tack really to have taken, if I think one had been sensitive to the very stiff, negative take that the Russian Federation, Putin, Lavrov, Medvedev were taking about the events in the Ukraine, which had an in for talks, which was, yes, we too are concerned with humanitarian issues of minorities in the Ukraine, and we would like to send in neutral observers,
right,
so forth and so on.
Maybe this is the time for the United Nations.
Pardon?
Maybe this is the time for the United Nations. I mean, is this not the sort of thing that Houthant
and from my perspective, Mr. Putin, of course, should have at least put a fig leaf on his interests in the Ukraine by going to the UN and saying, we have very grave concerns about our citizens and Russian-speaking minorities in the east and in Crimea.
Well, I think that's more of the fig leaf. I mean, the practical reality, and we should understand this and acknowledge this, is that roughly a third of his fleet is based out of Crimea.
Well, but the changeover.
I mean, if a third of our fleet was based out of Puerto Rico, the Venezuelan government tried to annex it, how would we respond?
Yeah, but there was no attempt at annexing the Black Sea fleet at Sevastopol by the new Ukrainian.
You wouldn't say that a coup d'état that brings down a government.
Oh, but it wasn't a coup d'état.
Okay.
You would not say that
bringing down a democratically elected government, replacing it with one that was not elected, is not in some way an annexation?
An annexation of what?
Of all the resources that government controls, which would include Crimea.
Crimea belongs to the Ukraine since 1954. It was given by Khrushchev.
My point.
It was turned over. Well,
my point. So if the government in Ukraine changes.
The program of the new leadership had nothing to do, never said anything about not wanting the Baltic fleet in the Crimea, never said anything about changing the autonomous status of Crimea.
Semi-autonomous.
It was entirely focused with respect to the East-West relations on an economic agreement with the EU. If you go and...
But wait a second, Stefan, excuse me. That economic agreement with the EU had a military piece to it.
Yes, I agree that it did. But that would be something that one might negotiate about, right? You'd say, okay.
Not if the EU is presenting it as take it or leave it.
Well, the current, that agreement was rejected by Yanukovych, okay? And so there would have been some new negotiations for some new economic agreement, which is actually what began in February 25th.
You're right.
Whatever.
And then the shots came out from the rooftop a day after.
That occurred, I think, on February 2021.
Okay. Interesting. Stefan, I'm flat out of time on this segment, but thank you for your thoughtful call, and we will continue this conversation as time goes on. It's 15 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Got any ideas on how to start a world war? I'd love to hear them. Or how to stop a world war, excuse me. Love to hear those. And welcome back. Let's hear from Sarah Palin for some real wisdom on this issue. Here she is.
Mr. President, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a nuke is a good guy with a nuke.
Oh, my God. This is the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. It's a nuke. Sarah Palin calling for nuclear war or the threat of nuclear war. How insane does it get? Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carolina, what's up?
Well, first I have to comment on the discussion of nuclear war. The Russians have other alternatives, which might be to put down our electric grid in our whole country for, say, 3 weeks, or how about 3 months? And I'd like for everybody listening to think about how would you survive for 3 months without any electricity off of the grid?
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I called was to alert the people who are against fracking that the frackers, the oil and gas companies, are probably behind the warmongering because it's a war for profit.
Well, and this was the deal that was cut back in November between Chevron, I believe it was, and the Yanukovych government, which was a multi-billion-dollar natural gas and oil deal where they were going to frack Ukraine.
Right. So, but the thing is that right now in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, there's a House Resolution 499. It's titled Condemning Violations of Ukraine's Sovereignty, and it goes on. And the last amendment that was put in there by Representative Poe from Texas was to force Obama to give an unlimited number of permits to export liquefied natural gas to Europe and the Ukraine. So, I mean, there's a stampede, which even the Democrats, even Alan Grayson, the best he could do in the Foreign Affairs Committee meeting was to improve on the wording of Poe's amendment. The Democrats have totally caved in, and so
they're all afraid of being called weak.
Frackers for freedom. This will be the motto of Shell and Chevron and Halliburton. And the whole point is we'll be stuck with the pollution from all the extra fracking since we have to supply Europe and the Ukraine with natural gas, which is a totally ridiculous idea. But that's what they're pushing. And in this House resolution, which will come up sometime this week, it also, I think, has to go through the Ways and Means Committee and maybe the Judiciary. It's a resolution, but they can be very influential. A resolution can be very influential, even if it isn't an actual law yet.
Sure.
But the whole point is to force Obama into giving unlimited permits to export liquefied natural gas. So I just want everybody to be alert to that and call their congresspeople and say, you know, we really don't want a war in order to make profits for Shell and Chevron and Halliburton. And plus, we're the ones that will get stuck with the pollution. So that's my main message. But back to the thing about the going without electricity, I was a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy in 1980 and helped prepare a publication titled Community Alert, Preparing for Energy Emergencies. So when I talk about the United States going without, whether it's gasoline or whether it's electricity, these are very, very serious.
Right.
Electricity is actually more serious than the
gasoline. I'm assuming you think that something like a Stuxnet virus could take down a grid.
Absolutely. And every security official who's got any brains at all has been saying for months, maybe even a couple of years.
Look out. Yep. Okay, we just have about 10 minutes here left in the show, and every single line is full, so let's try to be brief, and let's see how many calls we can get in here. Kiss Kid in Yucca Valley, California, watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Welcome back, Tom.
Very
sobering to listen to Professor Cohen, and to stop the war, like the previous lady said, everybody get on the phone, call our representatives, our senators. We stop that happening in Syria by jumping the gun. And we'll talk about voting another time.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot, kid. I appreciate the call. Merle in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Merle.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I missed you the other day when Sam was there.
Oh, thank you. Sam Cedar's good. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he is.
So what's on your mind?
I still got the same issue about no one addressing emergency unemployment benefit.
You're right. There are people out there losing their homes as we speak, literally losing their homes.
1.7 million.
Yep.
I lost my car.
Oh, my. I'm so sorry to hear that, Merle.
Heavy blazer, but...
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I mean, the cost...
This is the Republican Party trying...
...180 degrees and look at that building behind you.
Yeah. the Republican Party want to make the they're already portraying Obama as Jimmy Carter revisited, and the way that they and although the Carter president has been terribly mischaracterized, the way that they characterize it is as he was weak and feckless, and in fact he was the victim of Republican obstruction in many cases. They're doing the same thing all over again, and God forbid he goes to war as a way of showing that he can be tough. Merle, thanks for the call. You're absolutely right. We need to do something about it. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I hope you're well and ready.
I am. Thank you.
Your vacation.
Thank you.
You're one of the hardest working dudes on TV for sure. I have an immense amount of respect for you. I just want to say quickly, back to the beginning of your conversation, and I will be brief. Self-defense is a right. It's a human right. Self-defense. No matter who's attacking you. Self-defense. And then I want to skip, just to be brief, I want to skip way ahead to the assassin up on the building top. You know, if the government of Ukraine couldn't shoot that dude off the top of that building while he's killing their police and killing people, then they have no... They obviously have no authority in their country. Now, you know...
Or they weren't expecting an assassin on the top of the building.
Was born out of fascism.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. It's happening in this country. It's happening in the Ukraine. It's happening in certain places. I'm all for the continuation of squashing Nazis. And I just want to say that, Tom, and I appreciate free speech.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. I appreciate it. Dave in Silver Springs, Florida. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? You have so many good guests on the show that so I have to pick a good topic, but you got too many good topics.
Pick one. You got 20, 30 seconds.
Well, I think Cohen was right on with most of what he was saying. Mm-hmm. I agree that, first of all, that we haven't done anything to promote the war or to negate it. We're promoting is what we're doing. Obama hasn't opened his mouth to correct anything that's going on, nothing. I don't understand why he's backed down on almost all his campaign promises, and now he's backing down on promoting the peace of the world.
Yeah.
You gotta stand up and say something, say it. Don't cut Molly Cobble around.
Yep, I'm with you, David. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you for the call. Sherry in Bradley, California. Hey, Sherry.
Hi, it's Wild Horse Sherry. Please don't cut me off. I have a quick thing to say. I want no more war. And also, the first few days Kerry was talking, what he was saying was that no country should go into another country on a pretext to war, on a false pretext.
Right.
Of course, then he dropped that because that's exactly what we did in Iraq. Also, Russia needs Crimea, like your point a few minutes ago. They need that port anyway. They're not going to let it go, just like we wouldn't let it go.
Yeah, I agree, Sherry, and I think that that's one of the things that's driving this. David, listening to WBAI in New York. Hey, David. David, you are on the air. David, I pushed the button by the time I heard your voice. I'm sorry. Mike in Morton Grove, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I promise to be brief. This is basically about Professor Cohen. If you go on, I told the young lady that took the call, the screener, if you go on Jewish News 1, and it was on March 3rd on Monday, I think it was called Who's Provoking the Unrest in Ukraine, or it could have been called Jews Call on Russia to Withdraw Troops. It's basically Rabbi Michael Kapustin, and I forgot the other rabbi's name, basically telling the media as well as the Times of Israel that know about the Nazism and all that, mm-hmm. what Professor Cohen was telling about. And
well, he wasn't saying that was the only force that was operating.
Well, I know that he was saying last time and this time not as much. Last time he was basically saying that and on Democracy Now! As well. And both rabbis basically said that's unfounded.
Well, if you listen to the words of these guys who are now in the cabinet, or if you listen to the words of their party, I mean, they are openly anti-Semitic, they are openly nationalistic, and they're openly aggressive. I mean, this, some may think, Mike, thanks for the call. Some may say that calling them Nazis is a slur. They didn't, that some of them wouldn't characterize themselves that way. But on the other hand, some of them embrace swastikas. But on the third hand, as I pointed out, I don't think that that's what's driving this entire thing. I think that there are much larger and much more well-funded forces. Coming up tomorrow, all the latest news and information you won't be hearing in the corporate-owned news media, plus your calls. And occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does begin with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your end. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.